Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone, and I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk Radio Show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I am from Bellevue, Washington. And tonight is a very special show tonight. It's special guest night, and I am honored announced that we have a very special guest. His name is Andrew Perry. He is a returning NAFTA family member. He is from San Diego, California, and he is also a survival professional. Before I tell you a little bit more about Andrew, I wanted to talk to you about NAFTA's mission. And I would like to encourage anyone, if you're streaming a show and you're intrigued and want to interact with our special guest, Andrew, and be a part of the panel. And being a panel member, you'll have an opportunity to ask Andrew a question or a comment related to what he's going to share with us this evening. I would encourage you to call in. No experience necessary. The number to call in is 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. I'll tell you a little bit more about NASCA because, as you know, NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. They have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to sexual abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. For the team member of the panel, all you have to do is dial this number, 646-595-2118. Before I introduce our guest, Andrew Perry, and go a little bit into more detail, he provides with a very nice bio on his background. I want to tell you about who's on the line besides our special guest, Andrew. We have Kim Lakin from Colorado. She is in her last, she's in her last evening of training to also become a co-host for our show. John Anderson from Louisiana, my co-host this evening. Murray, good afternoon, John. Bill Murray, our founder and CEO of NASCA. I think he's officially trailing me tonight, but I know John's on. So, so I appreciate John being on and trailing me. And Peter from Toronto, Ontario, because as you know, we are an international organization at NASCA, and we are represented all over the world. So we appreciate having everybody on the panel tonight. I want to tell you a little bit more about our special guest, Andrew Perry. He is a trauma specialist. He is a psychotherapist from San Diego, California. He is a returning NASCA family member. who is the founder and executive director of Sexual Assault Awareness. He's been called the nation's leading authority on the arousal mechanism in sexualized violence and a pioneer in sexual assault treatments that bridge the gap from the world of psychology to the world of hidden sexual expression, often expressed in the kink / BDSM realm. As I mentioned, Andrew is a psychotherapist. He has 30 years experience treating female survivors of sexual abuse and assault, including sex workers. He is a board member and certified program director with the Center for Positive Sexuality. He speaks and trains nationally on taboo aspects of rape and sexualized violence, and a contributor to the Me Too. Counselors and psychotherapists speak about sexual violence and abuse. This is where Andrew told his own story for the first time. He became interested in these issues when working with a colleague and found it was quite common for survivors to delay recovery due to feelings of shame or guilt and a sense of childhood sexual assaults. Children are helpless, innocent, and powerless against predators. The responsibility belongs to the predators, not the child. To quote Andrew, he said, "I had assumed this was common knowledge in the field. I have since learned that there is still so much to do in basic education on arousal for survivors." Yes, I agree. Yes. So I'm going to bring Andrew on, and as I bring him on, I want to mention that we do the show in three segments. We try and do the show in three segments. About every 20 minutes, I try and break so that our panel has an opportunity to interact with Andrew and ask him a question or a comment around what he's going to share with us. So, Andrew, I know that there's so much to share, and I just wish that, you know, I wanted to welcome you on behalf of your NASCA family back onto the show. And I know you're going to, we're very interested in your own, obviously, story of your own experience. And so I'd like to invite you on and really, you know, where you wish to start with your story and fill us in wherever you're comfortable. And as you know, even though I don't need to tell you that you're the expert, you know, this is your show. So you can, you know, wherever you feel comfortable, whatever's in your comfort level, and you do not need to answer any questions you don't feel comfortable answering. So, but we just welcome you.
Well, thank you so much, Penelope. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and thank you both, Kim and John, for being on the panel tonight. It's always you know, wonderful to be here on the show. You know, huge thanks to Bill Murray for initially inviting me. Thanks to Dr. Deborah for initially introducing me to Bill several years ago. And I think this is my, fourth or fifth time on the show. I'm not sure. And each time it seems like I have something new, something controversial to talk about. So it's always great to be here.
Well, we really appreciate
you
being here. I'm sitting on the edge of my seat. I'm just so intrigued to hear everything you have to share.
Well, you know, I realized I was kind of reviewing the last show when I was talking about guided rape exposure therapy, which was really new at that time, which I think that was May of 2020, so a year and a half ago. And I had been working on that for a couple of years. And I realized that I kind of talked about that much later in the show. So I really wanted to introduce that and, you know, talk about that and answer questions much earlier this time because we didn't end up getting a lot of time. There was so much other, you know, things that came up. But I think what I would like to do to start, as you mentioned, you did such a wonderful intro. I almost feel like I don't have a whole lot to talk about. But what I thought I might do is to read a short excerpt out of the my own story in the book, hashtag Me Too, Counselors and Psychotherapists Speak About Sexual Violence and Abuse. And a little backstory on that, I was invited by Deborah Lee and Emma Palmer, who are both writers and editors and therapists in England, and they were looking for psychotherapists to tell their own stories and how it informed their work, and to kind of comment on their aspect in the Me Too movement. This is about 2-3 years ago, and the book was published, I think, I'm going to say 2019. So it's been out for a little while. It's on Amazon, and it's on PCCS Books. And it's a wonderful volume. It's not just my story. There's about 12 of us in there. But where I was particularly honored is I believe I'm the only American and the only male to have been included in the book, to have my story in there, because most of them are therapists in the British Isles. So with your permission, I thought I would just read a couple of paragraphs out of this that just kind of highlights a little bit of what I went through at that time.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. So I talk in the book about that I had numerous experiences leading me towards the work I do now, and then going into the chapter, what I wrote was, what I don't talk about is my own personal awakening. What I don't mention is my own experience of being sexually harmed as a teenager by someone close to me for years. This book gives me another opportunity to help others through my journey from slumber into daylight. It feels strange and awkward to review that time in my life and put it into writing after so many years. Years of keeping it all in from my teens, through college, into adulthood and marriage, years of therapy before I could first painfully admit, then begin to speak about what happened to me, how it affected me, how for much of my life I played a role, a persona, which was only parts of me. Years of pain and anguish lived because of someone I loved did to me. Nearly 10 years of clouding reality with cocaine and alcohol and choosing a dream of a life instead of full immersion. Finally, years of understanding, of learning, of loving myself, of making sometimes painful decisions towards healthier outcomes, to turn years of hurt into decades now of helping others who hurt the same, sleeping through life while awake and living. This is also a story of silent violence, a quiet sort of abuse that added to the original. And that wasn't by my perpetrator, but later, by my wife, my parents, and others when I disclosed as an adult. But let's back up to the beginning, to the darkness, at night, asleep. And I'll stop there. The title of my story is While I Was Sleeping, because that was when much of my abuse occurred, was at nighttime. But I'll leave that story there. If people are interested, they can read the rest of it in the book.
Wow. Now, I have a question for you, Andrew. And I'm, as I'm listening and towards the end, you mentioned your wife, your family, and basically their response or reaction to your disclosure.
Right.
Of you, and that, correct me if I heard incorrectly, but that was a continuation of pain for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
In a number of different ways. There was, I mean, obviously, you know, everyone has their attitude and take. And I call that silent violence. And I think that's something that a lot of survivors suffer through, is the reactions of people in their lives when they first disclose. I think we all know that for a lot of people, that's why they don't disclose, because they fear the reactions of other people. Not just friends and family, but society, and, you know, being told that they were mistaken or wrong, or they let it on, and, you know, all of that kind of nonsense. But for me, it was, especially with my wife, the issue was once it came out with her, she insisted on taking actions that I wasn't ready to take. She wanted to out my perpetrator. She wanted me to go to the police. She wanted me to do all of these things. And at this point, it had been, you know, years and years and years past the abuse. And I was, at that time, just starting to work on it. And I really felt like I needed time to kind of think through, feel through, work through everything I was dealing with at that time. So that was a huge conflict between us, and something we had to do a lot of, you know, work within our relationship on. And, you know, similar with my parents. My parents, to give them credit, were very loving, supportive, caring people. And yet even their reactions, you know, making it kind of more about them, like, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you trust us? Why didn't you say anything? That kind of stuff. So a lot of challenges like that, which, you know, I now years later, I understand where they're coming from. They wanted to be able to help me and support me. And at the age I was when it all happened, I wasn't in a place where I felt safe doing that. So, you know, I think there's those kinds of things are pieces of what we deal with as survivors.
And I thank you for clarifying that. And I, you know, you touched on something that, you know, really resonated with me. And as you know, we have a lot of people that, if they're not on the panel, they're streaming and they're listening. And this is also archived, you know. So, you know, our archive shows are accessed frequently and help so many people. What you highlighted is there's this, there is, I think we make ourselves very vulnerable when we first have the courage to speak our truth. And just, you know, you mentioned that, you know, after all these years, you know, you did finally, you know, you came forward and you verbalized it. And, you know, the way you describe even the well-intentioned reaction of the family members, right? I think we just remember that we are in a place of a new place in our vulnerability, and those, you know, yes, for them to be aware that whatever they say and their reactions have an impact on us. But I think, you know, it's also good to be aware that we are going to, you know, be receiving these reactions, and they do also have an impact on us. And it's, you know, we want to stay the course, and I think you took this big step to stay the course, but it's, you know, this is not unusual. I can hear my story and yours, and I know that other people are resonating with it as they're listening or will be listening in. That is not unusual, right? It's almost like there's these layers, right? There are these layers, and it's not all smooth sailing once you finally speak your truth.
Yeah, I think oftentimes people feel, you know, wide range of reactions, but sometimes resentful that, you know, your disclosure has disrupted their lives, and now they have to deal with that, or they have to deal with the, you know, fallout from that, whatever that is for them, rather than centering the survivor, they center themselves.
Did that feel like an additional trauma to you?
Yeah, I think that's where I came up with that term, silent violence. It's the kind of the aftermath of disclosure for a lot of people. And, you know, even in my own work, a lot of what I work on with the women I work with is, how do I tell? How do I reveal? How do I disclose? I'm ready to talk about it with my friends, with my family, with my partner. You know, how do I do that? And one of the things I prepare them for is, you know, even a supportive reaction may not initially feel supportive. You know, I said with my parents, you know, why didn't you tell us? You know, on the one hand, that's a very loving statement. It's like, we would have been there for you had we known, is what, you know, the underlying message. But it came across as an accusation of like, well, you know, I didn't trust them enough, or I didn't care about them enough to reveal this, you know, incredibly painful thing I was going through at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's totally understandable.
Yeah, you know, I think if you're okay with this, Andrew, even though we're still in the beginning, I'd like to bring in the panel and run down the panel if you're okay with that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So, you know, Kim, I just want to invite you in. I know you and Andrew briefly met before the show, but invite you in to offer a comment or a question to Andrew.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me, Penelope, and hi, Andrew, again.
Hello.
No, I am just, you know, I'm just honored to hear your story, and I don't really have a whole lot to ask you about. I'm always, you know, just interested in hearing a lot of then your work and what you're doing, too, as I know that, it, you know, our body plays a big part in our healing, and I deal with a lot of spine issues, and there's a couple other people on the call too that deal with that, and I know that the trauma also kind of goes, sometimes it goes to places like that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But that's a part, yeah, that's part of it. So I thank you for all the work that you're doing, and for the book. I'm interested in reading your book, so I will look it up and get a copy of it.
Terrific.
I'd love to do that.
Well, like I said, there's many wonderful stories from a lot of great people in there. It's not just my story. It's a collection.
I love those. I love those kind.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the best. I was in one as well, but not too long ago, about a year ago. So, yeah. Well, thank you. And I'm sorry that you had to go through what you had to go through, too.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm a huge believer in, you know, the things that we go through can, not always, but can provide us with skills, resources, strength to then help reach out to others, just like you're doing with the show, like all of you do in your lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I also teach another class, too, so maybe I'll bring that up later.
But wow.
I'll let
okay.
You know, come on.
What's the title of your book?
So it's Stories of Roaring Faith. It's a Christian book. But I didn't actually write the book. I was just in it. So
I was
very honored to be a part of it. Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. And it's stories of people who have overcome stuff in their life and how you deal with it and how we're trying to move forward. All of us, we're just all trying to move forward.
Beautiful.
Keep going forward. But, thank you.
Thank
I will
you,
friend
Kim.
Request you, too. I like to do that on Facebook, if you're on there.
Well, thank you, Kim. Thank you. And John, I wanted to invite you in the conversation with Andrew.
Hello, everybody. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, great. Well, Andrew, I can tell you, man, you are really a warrior, man. You are so extensive. And how many years have you been doing this now?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think for a long time I said about 20, and then I realized it's actually about 30 at this point.
Yeah, it's probably 30.
Yeah.
That is just unbelievable, you know, because I have a lot to talk to you about, and I want to bring some of it out. You know, actually, Kim just brought up a really good subject about being physically impaired due to psychological impacts of trauma, you know, and the way that the brain reacts to several types of abuse, not just sexual abuse, also physical abuse and verbal abuse. You know, there's a lot. But when someone is actually what I would be a victim of a serious crime, a rape, let's just get down to it, okay, when they're young, what do you think happens to a person as they get older? Do you think it affects the neural system? Do you think it affects the way they live? How they, you know, make decisions and live their life and just have the develop a personality because of the things that happened to them when they were young. I mean, what's your feelings on that, being, you know, the person
I won't give you my feelings. So I'll give you my thoughts and some facts.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question at this point. We have so much science and research backing up everything you just said, that, you know, whether it's sexual trauma, physical trauma, when you have a constant flow of cortisol, adrenaline, and the other, you know, I imagine everyone in the show is familiar with the fight, flight, freeze, you know, primal brain reactions when we're threatened. And when that is constantly stimulated, you know, especially if you live in a home where there's, you know, ongoing abuse, ongoing fight, ongoing, and you're living, you know, you're kind of, what's the word, stewing in a cocktail of your own you know, neurological stimulants.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It affects development.
Yeah,
it affects the brain.
Yeah.
It affects decision-making.
And
it affects our ability to reason and problem-solve and all of those things. It affects us physically as well.
Hey, man, you have just hit, like, everything on the head that I would think would be causes or reactions, you know, to triggering somebody to have, you know, extensive brain damage is what it comes down to. Don't you agree with that? To just get down to the bottom line and say it's brain damage.
You know, I've never used that term before, but that's not incorrect. Yeah, I'd say there is definitely a type of damage. I think what I would say is, though, it's healable. It's not like, you know, what we would think of as genetic brain damage or if you got into a head trauma. But I think it's healable damage.
That I have to engage in that healing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you specified on that because I believe in that also. But it's still at some point, you know, the brain has been damaged one way or another by the trauma and the impact, you know, of what happened. So we have to recognize that these things are very, you know, contributing to the factors of how a person lives the rest of their life, you know, and they were damaged, you know. So it's very important, I think, that we recognize that. I really do, you know. And thank you for clarifying that because that's, to me, it's very accurate and no sense of it all. I mean, it is. It's right on. And, you know, I thank you for being here tonight, by the way. You know,
thank
I'm
you
always,
so much.
You know, I have another organization and, you know, I'm always ready to talk to somebody that has, you know, the type of knowledge and the experience that you have, you know, to bring us tonight. And that's the best part about this, you know. So after you talked in the beginning, I was like, wow, you know, I didn't realize the extent of the effort that you are putting into this. It is really, really, I mean, just outstanding. And you know, I want to let you know. I want to let you know that just because you're over there in where the Chargers are playing later, by the way. I'm just saying, you know. Yeah, but anyway, are you a fan?
Well, we could be friendly rivals.
No. Actually, I like that side because that's where Drew Brees came from. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm from New Orleans, so, you know, he had so many great years. But anyway, the reason, you know, I just wanted to thank you for everything you've been doing. And,
thank
you know, when you talk about silent violence and the aftermath of it, too, you know, I have another term that I use and you know, the business that I really focus on, and it's a lot of what you do, and it's called murdered souls, you know, and it's only a term. It's only a term that I use that a friend of mine who I'm going to be speaking with, and I hope she has a book. Her name is Vicki Reichs. If y'all don't know Vicki, you know, I'm sure she wouldn't mind mentioning her name. But anyway, you know, she's the one that first brought that up to me, and I'm like, you know, that's pretty much the extent of it, you know, when it gets down to you know, a child that is 8, 9, or whatever age, really. It doesn't really matter. I hate to use ages because they use it against us, you know. And it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. So, which brings up the statute of limitations, and that's what I do, okay? I basically go after the statute of limitations to abolish them when it comes down to any type of harming children in any way. I don't, you know, really care if it is physical abuse or if it's, you know, just sexual abuse. So I don't even classify those even in difference in some way sometimes because the trauma that comes out of it is extent. I mean, you know, think of a child being beaten and then also a child that's been petted and then been raped. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, so you tell me. You know, yes, it's different avenues and different ways, but, you know, the brain has been affected. You know, by the situation, you know.
Yeah.
So.
And
you know,
you're an attorney, John, or a policy advocate?
No, I am. I'm an advocate big time. I actually work with attorneys. I work with lawyers all over the nation. Okay.
Wonderful.
I also work with victims on a daily basis. You know, I have several victims that come to me.
Yeah, there's so much about the legal structure and the legal system that
that's what
continually needs to be changed and continually needs to be addressed. that's where the statute of limitations is just one piece, but there's so many.
Yeah, that's just one piece. You said it.
Yeah,
and that's where I am, because here's the connection between what you do and basically where I'm at. Okay, is that I need to learn about what you're doing. You know, this is the main thing that I'm after right now, because if I don't learn enough education behind me and I'm not going to go up there and defend the world and I don't know what I'm talking about, I'm going to look like a fool, you know. But I'm at the state right now where I'm putting people in jail right now, okay. I'm backing my people up and I'm making sure that these victims get, you know, what they need if it's going to come down to that. So I need to learn exactly what you're doing, and I really appreciate you coming on tonight for this, because I definitely need everything that you offer, you know, and I would like to talk more about too, if you can go on from where you were and continue on about the way that you were rushed.
We got to go to other people, though, John.
Yeah, I know that too. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. So believe it or not, I become timely a little bit. So we're into the 58th minute of this, and I'm sorry, and counting, meaning that we've got less than an hour left of the show. We're at 15 minutes left. So I know there's so much to discuss, right? And Andrew brings so much to the table with his expertise and his experience. There's a lot more that we need to get through. And so, Bill, I just wanted to invite you in. Thank you for being on tonight. And bringing Andrew into our family, because we are all definitely enjoying the conversation with him.
Well, I keep dragging him back in. He's a friend of mine.
Hey,
I've known him for many years, and I've sat through, you know, his presentations, and you know, he's always got a ton of stuff, and. You can talk in all different directions, and you wouldn't finish if you talked all night. But I just want to say thank you to Andrew, and you know, he does take this. He takes NASCAR seriously, which I appreciate, and he takes the subject very seriously. I heard him talk, and I expected him to someday admit that he was a survivor. Now that's Andrew and I. Talked about that at one point, but I knew, and you know, and it's cool, but a lot of people who go into the psychology areas are kind of there to figure themselves out, you know, and I don't know if that was your case or not, Andrew, but you know, I was not at all surprised when a couple of years ago you came out with this, because I was waiting for it.
Well, you know, I think I talked about this last time, but one of my reasons for not doing so is, as a therapist, I didn't want to center myself and my story in the work that I do. And I think part of my concern, you know, there's the, if you want to call it like the celebrity therapist or the, you know, there's people out there who I think kind of center themselves rather than the work. And I was always cautious, you know, especially with my clients about, you know, if it was relevant and a client, you know, brought it up in therapy or asked me specifically, or I thought it was going to be helpful to their work, then yes, of course, I would talk a little bit about my own experience, you know, very individually, selectively. But I always felt a little, you know, not that I was, you know, ashamed or, you know, especially once I worked through it, I was just concerned about it drawing attention away from the people who I was working for. So that was my
I appreciate that, because I was sensitive to that. We have, you know, two shows every week where we have professionals who are also survivors, and they come on and they have the challenge. They have the challenge of answering the topic or answering the questions that the panel brings up or whatever it is from both perspectives. So they can do it either way.
Right.
Here's my professional. What I learned as a professional. Here's what I feel as a survivor. You know?
Right,
actually,
right.
It's pretty powerful, you know, format for the two shows a week. So that's on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So, and you know, maybe we'll have you do one of those. That'd be great. You're wonderful.
Right.
So, you know, I would definitely, maybe when we have the next person, tell me that they have a conflict with a date that's coming up, we'll call you and see if you can come on.
Sure.
But it's the same hour as this. So, all right? Well, anyway, I got off the phone, and thank you again, Andrew. Mm-hmm. You're a wonderful guy, and I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You bet.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank you. And, Andrew, I'd like to now bring on panelist Peter from Ontario, from Canada. Peter, you're on with Andrew.
G'day, Penelope. G'day, everybody. Peter,
oh, my gosh, I forgot my good day. I forgot my good day. Good day, Peter.
you're getting there, Penelope.
That was a C. I know.
I don't know what your full story is because I've never heard your story, sir, but from what you have shared, I just want to say thank you for sharing. It just gives me a bit of an insight to listen to other stories, to listen to others who tell their stories so that I can get somewhat of learning and feedback for myself so that I can understand myself. So I just want to say thank you for your time of sharing so that I can take it in and learn a lot more what to expect of other people. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Appreciate having you on as always. Okay, well, Andrew, we're back to the top, and so you left us with, you know, when you shared your story and then the reactions from your wife and your parents, and there's so much to cover here. I'm going to just turn it back over to you. I mean, clearly, we'd be here for hours.
Well, I think what I would like to do is kind of jump over, as I said, to the work that I've been doing for the last number of years, really. And I've talked about, you know, some of them on the show, and just, for your sake and anyone new listening in, kind of a brief recap of the last maybe 10, 15 years. And I won't go into a whole thing about it, but I started doing a lot of public speaking and research and work on arousal during sexual assault, on the experience, especially for women, because that's who I primarily work with, of experiencing arousal, orgasm, you know, whether it was during child abuse or as an adult during a rape experience or something like that, of having that experience. And it's something that I realized a number of years ago that isn't really written about, isn't really discussed. If there's an awareness of it, it's far more on the survivor side and very silent, very private. And it was coming up in my work. And so I started looking more deeply into literature and research and realized there was almost nothing on it. So kind of cut ahead to 2019, I had worked with a graduate student who did the first ever published research validating the existence, the experience, and then a number of traumatic markers like increased anxiety, increased depression, decreased reporting that go along with arousal. So looking at, you know, someone who didn't experience that versus someone who did, we see a number of differences in that. And so one of the, you know, things that I talk about a lot is just like we talk about releasing and removing the shame of the event itself, also addressing that aspect about arousal and orgasm during sexual assault. So that was one piece of my work. And then it jumped to another level. I had a client, this is now a number of years ago, who disclosed to me that she was going out at night and deliberately dressing provocatively, deliberately going to what were dangerous areas in her area that she lived in, and trying to get herself raped, which, you know, I think to a lot of people is shocking. I think to a portion of survivors may not be, because as I discovered,
like
I worked with her.
Yeah. I'm sorry, that
well, that's an aspect of it,
right?
Yeah. There. Yeah. Well, you know, the way I look at it, because I look at all human behavior as trying to move in the direction of growth, trying to move in the direction of health. Even something that looks very self-harming or negative on the outside is an attempt to move us forward. And so, you know, that's the perspective I work from. So she and I worked together for a while. We did a lot of healing work. But it kind of left me with this thought of, well, if this person's doing it, there must be other people out there doing it. And I ended up kind of diving into various websites and Tumblr and different things, and I found that there are not just individuals but communities that talk openly about what is in the BDSM realm. It's called consensual non-consent, which is when a partner agrees to enact being forced or raped or that kind of thing, and they're doing it for sexual pleasure. So that's one piece of it. The woman who I was talking to was not doing it for that reason. She was doing it, as you said, as kind of a self-punishment or a, you know, but to her it was also a sexual turn-on. So there were these twin elements of incredible arousal for her, but then matched with incredible shame after the event. And I found communities of women online who were experiencing and doing the same thing. And so one phrase for it is rape kink, people who deliberately engage in this. And I interviewed, you know, at this point, probably close to 100 women, and I presented on this and talked about it at various conferences. And one of the key themes that I found, because at first I was just fascinated, like, this is happening, I want to learn more about it, I want to understand it. And the responses I got from many of the women were, when they engaged in this, at least for a period of time, they had a reduction in their trauma symptoms, the anxiety, the self-harm, the depression, all of the things that go along with being sexually assaulted and not, you know, unhealed sexual assault, I mean, not having addressed it in therapy, that they experienced this reduction. And I started thinking about the work that I do, which is exposure therapy, which is a very well-researched, specific kind of trauma therapy where you know, in incremental amounts expose the person to the thing that traumatized them in a safe way, in a guided way, et cetera. And I started applying it to this idea, and I developed a therapeutic model that, for lack of a better name at this point, I call guided rape exposure treatment or guided rape experiential treatment. And it basically is a method where taking it out of the office where I will, you know, traditionally exposure work is done verbally. Like, you walk the person through the events, you have them talk about it as if they're in the moment, you have them process the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations that comes up in the safety of the therapeutic relationship. So I was talking to these women and realized there's this whole other opportunity where if there was a guided element and some education about why they were doing what they were doing, because many of them just felt compelled to do it and didn't understand why. And when I added some of that education, like, well, here's what's happening neurologically. Here's what's happening, you know, in your brain. This is why you might be attracted to this kind of thing. This is why you're getting a benefit out of it. It kind of opened a whole door for them. And so it helped me to kind of validate that there may be a positive to this. So I developed this treatment out of that. And I could talk more about it, but I know I've just kind of laid out a lot there. And, you know, if you want me to go through a little bit of the steps of it and how it works and all of that, I can do that. But I'll stop there for a minute.
You know, I am intrigued. I am very intrigued. And I just think it's interesting, too, because, you know, a lot of time when we listen in, we're learning about new modalities of treatment and maybe some that we're not familiar with. And I know it's not one size fits all, as we all know, when it comes to the healing journey and different modalities, you know, some
right.
Do, some don't. Do you think, you know, this is the, you know, just, it's educational. So, you know, I am a little bit more, you know, I'm interested maybe in a little bit, you know, a top line, right? But just need a little bit more information. Because what I'm thinking is
something,
you know, just, you know, it's not about me, but, you know, when you're a child sexual abuse survivor, this happened to you without your consent. And like,
right.
This happened to you off the sleep, right, off in my bed. But I didn't have any, there was no consent. I had no control. This happened to me without, you know, my, I was completely, at, there was no control, is what I'm saying on my part.
Right.
So
right.
Me, it sounds, I'm hearing this, I'm feeling like, you know, it sounds almost like, at first I said, yeah, self-punishment, but it also sounds like, well, if these patients or these people are choosing this, they did assume some sort of control over what's happening. It's almost like rewriting that history.
You are absolutely hitting on a key piece of the modality and why it works.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, some of
the, I don't know if you want me to say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, because I lost my train of thought in terms of consent. I'm sorry, there was literally being asleep. There's no consent, right? So yeah,
right.
It sometimes seems like there's an element of consent and control.
Right. Well, and I'll take a small step back. It's no secret that for a lot of survivors, there is a fair amount of sexual dysfunction, or at least that's the term that we use. I'm not a huge fan of that term because, again, I look at behaviors in terms of I might be trying to heal something, I'm just not going about it in the best way. But the whole concept of engaging in whether we call it promiscuity or sexual aggression or sexual acting out, whatever phrase we use, no secret that for a lot of survivors, they engage in a lot of sex after those events. And part of that is like you said, wanting to take control, wanting to bury the original event, wanting to balance the original event. Well, if I have sex with 60 other guys, then maybe that time I was raped is just one of many, many times that, I engaged in some kind of sexual behavior, even though, they know very clearly that that time was not wanted, not consented to, not desired. And so it doesn't really work trying to bury it in that way. They're still left with that, the feeling of whether it's shame or anxiety, depression, all of those kinds of things. So what this model does is it gives them an opportunity to choose, to consent, to select elements of what happened to them and then reenact them with a chosen partner, and we can talk about that piece as well, and kind of go back through what happened in a very experiential, very physical way, not just talking about it in the office, but actually, in a sense, re-experiencing it. I want to be very cautious in saying that, while I've put some of this into practice and I've had some good success, this is by no means something anyone should just jump into or do. There are a lot of, pitfalls, especially outside of the therapeutic context. So I want to be really cautious saying that because I know I've spoken to some people and they're like, oh, okay, so if I go do this, I'll be better. I'm like, no. You have to, a lot of education, a lot of guidance, and bringing you along that goes in this before someone engages in something like this. But the basic idea with some of the women I've worked with in the last couple of years is to walk them through the model, how it works, talk about their story. And I'm giving a very shortened version of what I do, but walk them through their story, highlight what I call the trauma points or the trauma moments, like what are the moments that most haunt them or most stick out for them now, years later as an adult or months later, depending on when it happened. And then that forms the basis for designing the enactment, and that's something that we talk about together in the office. But within that, I do a lot of stabilization work, a lot of grounding work. I have no interest in triggering someone into a panic attack or any of that. So we do a lot of healing work early on to make sure that they have the tools so that if during the enactment they're triggered in some way, they and the partner they're working with both understand how to de-escalate them, how to bring them out of it, if they have dissociation or anything like that. So there's a lot of that pre-work that goes into it. And then the design of the enactment and then the enactment itself, which I do not participate in. I'm aware of when it's happening, where it's happening. But then if the person's needing to talk to me after the enactment, I'm available to them, but it's usually left to the next session where then we start the process of talking through how it went for them, what happened, how are they feeling now, what benefit did it have for them, did we explore the right trauma moments, is there more that we need to do? So we walk through all of that together. And that process is a number of weeks. And then we talk about whether another enactment is needed or necessary. At this point, it seems, and I say it seems a lot because, you know, don't have tons of data, but it seems like multiple or several enactments are necessary to walk through this. And someone's puppy is barking in the background. I just heard. So lots of healing benefits. When I, you know, talk to them afterwards, you know, again, the reduction of depression, the reduction of anxiety, the reduction of self-harming, substance abuse, all of these kinds of things, and lasting longer and for a longer period of time than when they were out, for those who were doing it on their own, that they were out doing it on their own, and certainly was a huge reduction in shame, self-blame, self-hatred, self-loathing, all of that stuff that goes along with it. So again, I'm going to stop there, see if there's questions or direction that you want me to go in.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's just, thank you for, you know, explaining it in the way that you did. And just to reiterate and to sort of recap, so first of all, don't try this at home. This is to be done in a setting. A lot of clinical expertise and groundwork that needs to be laid, so do not try this at home.
Absolutely. Yes.
And it, to me, it does also sound like it is something that is it's a process,
mm-hmm.
not a one and done. So I think I just had to, you know, put that out there, reiterate, you know, but it does sound very...
No, thank you. Thank you for doing that.
It has had some success. Has had a lot of success. So that's very, very interesting. And I had never, this is new to me. I'd never heard of that. But I definitely am intrigued. So we're at 37 minutes left. So I'm going to go, I'd like mm-hmm. to get on the panel again. And of course, but I would have more to share with us, and we have so many more questions for him. I'd like to limit to a minute per panelist, please, if possible, so that we can then get into the third segment and have enough time to get through what Andrew wishes to get through. So, Kim, I'm going to bring you back on, and you're on with Andrew. Oops, well, I just put her on, you know what? This is, I'm trying
hey,
to
get
you muted
here.
Me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I'm not
ready. I don't really have a question. I'm just fascinated in listening to what you're saying, and it's been just a learning process for me as well the last few years that I've really started digging into, you know, my own processes. And it's taken me 53 years, and so I think it's amazing that some of the people out there are really interested in starting this process earlier, and I really admire that, too. So I guess I don't have anything. I do more of a prevention side, which we can maybe chat about later another time.
mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating. Thank you so much for just all that you're sharing.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you. John.
Hello, everybody.
Hey.
Listen, I wanted to ask you one thing earlier where mm-hmm. I left off, and I know you had mentioned about you were being rushed for a while, you know, by, I guess, your wife, you said, or...
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I wanted to ask you what type of impact does that do to you at the time when you're being rushed in that situation when you know you're not ready to take that step yet? And how far did it take for you to move on to the next step?
Well, you know, a lot of discussions with my therapist at the time, you know, a lot of processing of that feeling of, you know, as Penelope was talking about, you know, consent, control, all of those elements are so important to healing, and I believe they need to be centered for each survivor in their healing, that, you know, options can be presented, directions can be presented, suggestions can be made, but ultimately they have to make the decision of what healing looks like for them. And
exactly.
So that was a lot of, you know, I knew that as a therapist because I was, at the time, I was a young therapist just kind of coming into the profession. So I knew that intellectually, but I had to experience that and, you know, hear my therapist say, it's okay to slow down. It's okay to, you know, have conversations with your wife about how you want to move this forward and what you need. And you know, a lot of reassurance to slow the roll on that. While also respecting, because, you know, my wife had her point of view and the way she saw things, and while also respecting that and hearing her out, but saying, this is what I need to heal. This is my process and what I need to do, and being able to hold that.
Oops. Somehow John got dropped just now. So thank you. Andrew, thank you, because I heard that, though. And I appreciate what you just said.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we can all...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. You go on ahead.
I was just going to reiterate that, yeah, I think, you know, like I said, it's central to the healing for every single survivor to, you know, have that support. You know, and if I didn't have the... And I'm not going to sit here and say my wife is not supportive. She was very supportive in many, many ways. But there was also things that, you know, she felt strongly about, and I, you know, had to hear her out, but then I also just knew it didn't feel right for me, it wasn't time, so I had to be able to respond to that and be able to kind of hold my own as I was moving through this other stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that's important for survivors to recognize.
That is very, very important. That's such a key in a lot of ways from the root of it all, isn't it? It really is. You know, and there was another thing that you had mentioned earlier, and I'm really, really just interested in it because I think it has a lot, you know, to do with a lot of people's decisions on which way they want to recover. In other words, if they, you know, coming out and they want to heal, and you know, it's just a lot of confusing avenues that people take on the way, right? You know, and we know this, but you are a therapist, and you do, and you're way of that particular kind, and have you engaged or know of responses, let's put it that way, on people that have had, say, EMDR, people who have rapid eye movement therapies, you know, and things like this, okay, compared to yours, and how do you relate that, you know, in people? You know, because I know it's a touchy subject. I know it is because everybody's not the same. And I hate to throw that at you, but I'm so interested in it because everybody, you know, is talking about this therapy or that therapy, which one is good for them. You know, so I'm interested in really, you know, how do you feel about those two in specific versus yours or in comparison?
Well, you know, I'll say this. You know, you've already said this. There is no one way to healing. There's no one path. I've certainly known people who got very involved in yoga and experienced, you know, body releasing and trauma releasing through that. In fact, there's a whole treatment called TRE, which is trauma releasing exercises, which is rooted in yoga. I don't have the book or the video in front of me. I think the creator is David Basseri. And that's a whole movement unto itself, which I'm a huge proponent of, and I you know, make those recommendations to people. So, you know, I don't think there's any, you know, there's probably, I don't know, half a dozen different quote-unquote trauma therapies. Exposure therapy is one, there's cognitive behavioral, there's various kinds of things. So I certainly am not one who sits here and say, you know, this is the best way and this is the only way. I am not EMDR trained myself. It is one of the things that I am planning on doing because I think it would be a good additional, you know, tool in my
Absolutely.
But I'm a believer in it. Full disclosure, I probably wasn't about about 15 years ago, I was very skeptical when it was kind of coming onto the scene, and I did some reading, and it, you know, it didn't quite, something has to make sense to me. I have to understand the science behind it before I'm going to promote it and recommend it. But, you know, there was a lot of studies, especially in the last decade, and I have college to use it. And I'm a big believer in it at this point, you know, and I do recommend it.
Okay.
You know, I'll refer to another therapist.
That's good to know.
Yeah, a lot
very
of different
good to
things
know from you.
Yeah, sure.
Awesome.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, John. And I'm going to bring Bill back in. Bill, you're on with Andrew.
Thank you very much. I don't know if Andrew remembers this, but, you know, as a separate part of the presentation he just made in the last few minutes, the early stuff, he talked about the stimulation that occurs with the female who experiences sexual assault or rape, and that it's almost always the female, that's who you work with and so forth. But I told you at one point that I, too, had the same experience. And
absolutely. Yeah, I'm not leaving males out of this, and I do talk about that when I do lectures and so forth.
I know you do, but what I want you to hear is that, of course you get stimulated and so forth, but when you're a young child and you don't know what's going on and the sensation is wonderful, that's what you go back for, the sensation.
Right.
There's no guilt. Yeah. There's no, you don't know what it is, you know. And the first time that I had an encounter with a fellow, it lasted about a month, every night for a month, I just couldn't get over this. It was fascinating. You know, it was unbelievable. I didn't feel any guilt. I didn't know what it was, you know.
Right.
But I was shocked by. And so later, now I went back, you know, I went to the playgrounds and so forth and found out some misinformation, but bad information about being, you know, a faggot and so forth, all that stuff. And now I was embarrassed. And then I was afraid. But not at first. I was thrilled. You know, because I finally had the sensation that I, and by the way, when you're prepubescent, at least this was the experience for me, there is no ejaculation, and the stimulation goes on and on and on.
Right.
And believe me, if guys could have it go on and on and on, they'd want to. Our experience sexually, the tingling session, let's say, put it that way, not to get too gross, doesn't go on and on and on. It lasts a few seconds. You know, it's not. But when you are prepubescent and this happens to you, you can have the experience for a half an hour straight. You know?
Right. Yeah, and you make such an excellent point about all of that, Bill. Thank you for raising all of that. That, you know, and I think part of that speaks to the culture of sexual shame. You know, not to say that it's obviously not okay for adults to prey on children, but that children have those sensations, and that as adults we don't normalize that in our sex education for children, that you're going to feel these things, it's okay that you feel these things, it's okay to, you know, experience that pleasure in private or with yourself, you know, not okay for other people to do that. But that they feel that way, absolutely. And I think it would go a long way in our society, in our culture, if we did do that kind of education for kids.
And let me just say finally that I didn't get any sex education, none, from home. So when this happened to me, I didn't know what it was. I had never even heard the word sex, for example.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so that when you don't, this is why we're so much in favor in the prevention area of, you know, teaching children as much as you can age appropriately, but as early as possible, and especially, you know, using vocabulary that later will be useful. They may not have use for it then, but they'll get it, you know. Kids are resilient. Yeah. So that was the one point. The other was the thing about the lifestyle people. I don't know if I should share about any of that, but I have something to say there. But anyway,
I'll put it out there.
We're
all friends here.
Nah, better not.
Okay. All right. I mean, I'll talk about some of that. But
okay.
Now, Andrew,
thank you again for being here.
Yeah. We're trying to get you back another show. You have to understand that, right?
We'll just dangle it out there, but we'll cover it.
I'm happy to. Now, give me some dates. I'll come back and go into more of all of this. But, you know, just to, if it's okay for me to jump in for a second, Penelope?
Sure.
Yeah. Just to kind of go off what Bill was just saying, so much of what I've learned these last number of years does come out of the, he called it the lifestyle community or the BDSM community or the kink community. Those phrases are not fully interchangeable because they mean different things. But, you know, for people who aren't used to those worlds, they kind of all blend together. But, you know, many of the women I've talked to were only able to explore these feelings and these ideas within the kink community, to be able to go in and find either a dom or a partner who is able to help recreate some of these experiences. And there's kind of a line that I use. There's people who sought out these repetitive experiences in, I'll say, fully consensual ways, either through, you know, privately in masturbation or reading erotic literature and that kind of thing, or with partners, or they would go, as I said, into maybe the BDSM world and go to a kink event, find someone who can help them with that. And then the line is where it crosses into what it's referred to as rape baiting in the community, where and I'm only familiar with women doing this. I don't know if men also. I imagine that's true. But who do the stuff I was talking about earlier, dressing provocatively, basically, you know, breaking all the rules of what we tell women not to do and going to seedy areas or leaving themselves vulnerable and exposed on dates or purposefully dating men who seem like boundary crossing or aggressive in order to have that experience. But the man is not aware. So in that case, that's why I separate those two things out. There's the situations that are fully discussed, consented to on all sides, and then there are these situations where the woman knows what she's doing. The man, in my opinion, is a rapist because he does. He's not aware that she's wanting or okay with that in those situations.
Yeah, that sounds like a double standard almost.
Yeah. I'm a little careful about going there. A lot of people, you know, I'll talk about this sometime. They'll say, well, the poor guy, he doesn't know that he's being baited. I'm like, yeah, to me, he's not the poor guy. He's taken his own choice. He's a criminal. He's a rapist, as far as I'm concerned. I have very strong feelings about that. That's my stance. But, you know, as the women have said to me many times, is no, like, that's my fantasy. He was my hero. He was the guy who did exactly what I wanted. And even if intellectually they could say, well, I don't want this to happen to another woman, and that would be horrific. I would never want, you know, I don't wish this on anyone. But for me, in this situation, it serves this need.
Right.
And I hear a lot of that kind of feedback.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Peter,
and you know, go ahead.
No, I say your comment, and I do want to bring on our last panelist.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, Peter, I've not forgotten about you. So, good day, and you are on with Andrew.
Good day, Penelope. No, to be honest, I don't have anything to ask. I'm just enjoying listening. I'm just enjoying listening to this topic.
Awesome. Well, thank you. We always appreciate having you on with us. So I did want to mention as an aside, Andrew, that I have to say that I was kind of cheering when you were saying you've had some, you know, patients that have benefited from trauma-informed trained yoga, because I am a certified trauma-informed trained yoga instructor. And I think effective modality in it just really helped to connect the mind and the body and with regulation integration. So I do believe that
absolutely,
for some people it's highly effective.
Well, just taking that a little bit further, I mean, I'm sure you're very aware that being in certain positions or certain holds and stances, poses, can bring out a lot of feeling. Sometimes joyful, happy feelings, sometimes painful, traumatic feelings, sometimes anger. So there's a lot of emotion that we store in the body. And, you know, anyone who's familiar with Bessel van der Kolk's work is familiar with that. And I think anyone who has done massage therapy, yoga, those kinds of things realizes how much we store. And you know, going back to kind of my treatment modality, that is one of the pieces that often comes out, is that the woman will talk about being held in a certain position is a trigger for her, or that's, you know, a trauma moment. And so being able to recreate that, re-experience that, and release that, being able to cry through it or be angry through it and have that release and then be able to come back into the therapy room and talk about that experience can be incredibly healing.
Yes, or not even realizing, maybe you know it's a trigger, but not realizing why. I think a lot of trust members have been able to come forward because, you know, I think those modalities help you to become more curious, and that gives you information if you have a certain reaction to something.
Well, and just talking about it in terms of, you know, partners and sexual barriers, I've had women who came to me and say, you know, I can't do these positions that my husband wants me to do, or my boyfriend wants me to do, or my girlfriend wants me to do, because that's the position that my abuser, my rapist had me in when it happened. So, you know, I can't do that without panicking or having an anxiety attack, and I want to be able to work through that. And so then that, you know, in that sense, that becomes a focus of treatment, of being able to do those things or being able to do, you know, certain sexual acts, you know, for their own pleasure and their partner's pleasure, things they maybe used to enjoy and now can't enjoy anymore and want to be able to again. So, you know, a lot of different pieces to the healing.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like an opportunity that if someone wants to break through those, to break through. Or to rewrite those, kind of get to rewrite the story.
That's a lovely way to say it, yeah, to rewrite that.
Yeah, thank you. So you did bring up in 2019, if I remember correctly, you had said it was really kind of the first time that this really issue had been verbalized and brought kind of into, I think, brought to life or brought to into the awareness was the toxic shame and the shame and the guilt that's carried because the body responded to arousal.
Right,
And I don't know if you feel like you've done your due diligence in the show in talking about it, or if you wanted to expand on that more. We've got 17 minutes left, so I just brought that up, but really I want to turn it back over to you because I want to make sure that you can get through everything that you wanted to address tonight.
Sure. Well, I'm going to give great thanks to the work of Kayla Bunderson. She's the graduate student who saw me lecturing, well, I guess like 5 years ago now, saw me lecturing on arousal and sexual assault and heard me talking about it and came up afterwards and was just, you know, astonished that there was no research and said, I'm about to do my dissertation. I want to do it on this. And so she and I did a lot of talking. We worked together to construct a survey design and methodology about how, you know, how to do this research, what it would look like. We had a heck of a time getting it. If people here are familiar with what an IRB is, an institutional review board, that's the university's kind of safety protocol for any kind of research or study to make sure that it won't be damaging to the people who that the study is going to be enacted on. And, you know, we were just talking about questions on a survey that was going to be done online. It was nothing, you know, invasive or interactive. It was, you know, pretty straightforward. And yet we had a heck of a time convincing the IRB of the benefits of this. But we did get it through. She did conclude the study. Her findings largely matched my own informal findings from over the years that I had just been doing my own interviews both with clients and with others online about their experiences, you know, having orgasm or arousal during sexual assault. So it's out there. I don't recall if Kayla published it. I know I was after her for a while to do that because I thought it was such an important study. If people are interested, I'll give all my contact information or they can find it, I think, on the NASCA website. You can find my website. If you find my website, you'll find me. You know, if people are interested in that study, I'm happy to share it. But I haven't talked to Kayla probably in close to a year, so I don't know if she followed through with publishing it or not.
Do you think that the, you know, I know you're a psychotherapist and you have, mm-hmm. you know, your areas of specialty, but mm-hmm. for a lot of, you know, the survivors of child abuse and sexual child abuse, you know, that we speak to, we know sometimes it's difficult to find the right trauma-informed therapist. But,
oh, goodness,
you know,
yes.
It's, of course, you know, there are really great trauma-informed therapists out there, but here's my question, too. How many therapists, psychotherapists, trauma-informed therapists are really versed on this subject of really the shame, you know, of the arousal, you know, the shame that's carried, you know, by survivors of sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse?
You know, I'll give two answers to that question. I'm going to say almost none on the one hand. And yet, I had the experience a couple of years ago of sitting next to a young woman who had just graduated with her degree as a therapist. And she had, this is kind of a funny story, actually. She had said, well, I was talking about my work and this, and she said, oh, I know all about that. Yeah. Like, orgasming during sexual assault and so the neurology of it and then, you know, how the brain reacts. And she went into it. I'm like, oh my gosh, where did you learn? She said, oh, I learned this from in one of my classes from my professor. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, you know, this stuff's getting out there. People are talking about it. It's more understood. And she put me in contact with her professor because I'm always intrigued to find others who also talk about this, also, you know, teach about this. And it turned out her professor knew me. And so I emailed her and like, oh, you know, I understand your professor and you taught this person, blah, blah, blah. And she said, Andrew, I knew you 10 years ago. We worked together. It's like you used to talk about this stuff all the time. I got it from you. And I've been teaching about it. And once she became a professor, she incorporated it into her teaching and so forth. So, but I do find, you know, it's like I said, the survivor community is certainly aware of it. And I talk about like the gap between the lived experience that survivors have and what we know in the psychological world. And I also talk about the gap between what we are trained in as sexual assault recovery specialists or trauma specialists and what is going on again in the kink or the BDSM world. There is a wealth of practices and information, many of which I believe to be healing, that we haven't studied, we haven't looked at. There's a good group, but a very small group nationally, and at least in the U.S., I don't know internationally, of psychotherapists who specialize in looking at alternative sexualities, at kink healing, at BDSM practices and how they're used in terms of not just trauma healing, that's kind of a even smaller category, but just relationship benefits, all different kinds of other things. And so in that world, I've gotten more kind of attention for incorporating those aspects into the work that I do. And so I think I'm one of a small handful of trauma therapists nationally who incorporate or talk about even BDSM and kink practices and how they can be helpful for people. Mm-hmm. And that's a bit of a separate thing from the arousal piece. The arousal mm-hmm. piece, you know, again, I don't hear a whole lot. One of the groups that I lecture to that I do get a lot of kind of affirmative nods from are SANE nurses, sexual assault nurses that work in rape recovery units, like, you know, where they have to gather all the evidence and all of that. Because mm-hmm. nurses are trained in what? Physiology and how the body works and how the body responds. So I have found actually nurses to be very aware when I talk about this, and I'll get a lot of nods and a lot of, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you
yeah,
for
I can
saying
see
that.
And, yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of work to do. I've done lectures for, you know, a decade at various psychological conferences, and I get a variety of responses. I get the head nods, but then I also get a lot of people coming up after, like, I've been doing this work for 15 years, 20 years, I've never heard this before, you know, this is, you know, great that you're talking about this. And to me, I think this should be basic information. I think that's what I get upset about, you know, and why I keep talking about it. This really should just be basic information. The body gets turned on, we get aroused, we get orgasms. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a wanted contact or an unwanted contact. This is just how the body reacts. And I think we need to put that out more on behalf of survivors. It's a very simple message, but it gets very complicated for people.
Well, I completely agree with what you're saying. Of course, I'm just a study of one. But, you know, for me, you know, in my own experience, and I was, you know, sexually abused, you know, and I woke up. I woke up because of the arousal. And for a 7 or 8 year old, I carried the shame and the guilt of being aroused. And that stuck to me. And I completely accepted 100% of the blame, the self-blame and hatred, just from the arousal alone. And really it was that arousal that repressed my memory because I had assumed the blame. So for me, it was the shame of arousal. I was not able to speak of it for the first time until I was, you know, 4 decades later. So
yeah,
it's a big issue
so
for
sorry.
Me just to have, oh, thank you. But just to have been told, you know, I don't think you can ever assume, I think it's, I'm an over-communicator, right, versus an under-communicator. Because
it's good that you're a radio show host.
Does that exist? I mean, does that really exist? I'm not really sure.
Exactly. But just that simple, just that concept of, you know, just arousal being a physiological response in the body and taking, that took the blame, the self-blame off of me, you know, having that reading about that subject matter. And it wasn't from my trauma-informed trained therapist, who I've been seeing for 3 or 4 years. He's very good.
Right.
It was from reading an article or getting a mailing. Somehow, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Margaret, because she's the one that wrote an article on shame and arousal and sexual abuse. I don't know if you know who I'm referring to. I don't even know.
Not off the top of my head, but I've probably seen it over the years because I go looking for, you know, data information.
Yeah.
But her name is Dr. Margaret, or is it Margaret something?
Yeah, it's just like Dr. Margaret. I think her book is like Perfectly Hidden Abuse. No, I'm sorry, Perfectly Hidden Depression. But she goes by Dr. Margaret. I don't know how I started getting these mailings from her, but it was a couple of years ago, so it wasn't like it was something that was out there, like you're saying. It's just to me,
okay.
I feel like it's coming more to the forefront now. But I, you know, the fact that you bring it up, though, you know, it was written in the bio that I read. In my own experience, but in my opinion, I think we need to talk about it more. I think
absolutely.
A lot of people, you know, hear about, you know, the shame, right? The shame, the self-blame that, you know, adult survivors of sexual child abuse carry with them. And I think this, you know, hits the nail on the head for many of us.
It does. It does. If I can say real quick about that is that, you know, when people come forward, though, you know, we have to support them at the youngest age as possible. You know, due to the fact of, I mean, long-term TPSD, depression, anxiety, you name it. But here's the issue, is that we have such an age gap between the people that are coming forward, which is like averaging about 52, okay? Then you have others that are coming out, you know, between the ages of 30 and 40, which I'm seeing a lot of right now. So I think it's a big factor about, you know, people coming out as early as possible. Don't y'all agree, you know, with getting help, you know, ASAP?
Oh, absolutely, of course. Yeah, no, the younger, the better, and the more chance to heal and recover much earlier and to not get into a pattern of, you know, maybe damaging relationships and so forth or self-harm and, you know, all of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Margaret Rutherford is the person you were talking about.
Yes.
Perfectly Hidden Depression,
yeah.
Dr.
Yeah.
Margaret Rutherford.
Yeah.
I just looked her up.
That's who it is. Yeah.
So,
I remember her.
So we're down to the last 5 minutes, Andrew. I know, believe it or not, as you know, the time flies during these shows. But I want you to tell us a little bit more about how to get a hold of you. I mean, I see, Andrew Perry, that you have a website, and it's called really Sexual Assault Awareness, and the web address is saawareness.com.
Yes, and the easiest way to say it is it's SA Awareness. The SA stands for sexual assault, but saawareness.com.
Great.
But I have found if people just look for my name and Andrew Perry, P-A-R-I, it's like Paris, France without the S, look for a name and either trauma or your trauma recovery or sexual assault, they'll find their way to my website or to something I've written. So, yeah, that's one way, and I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. I actually did posts about this show last week and today that I was going to be on here talking, so some of my followers out there will hopefully hear that.
And so are you in San Diego or in Los Angeles?
Thank you for asking. I actually moved to San Diego just in the past few months. Previously I was in the Antelope Valley area of Los Angeles, so very north of Los Angeles. But I've been seeing someone the last number of years, and she and I bought a house down in San Diego. She's also a therapist. In fact, she just came out with a book herself. We bought a house, when was it, 3-4 months ago. I'm rebuilding my practice down here, bringing in new clients, and kind of reestablishing myself.
So I understand, though, from your website that, yes, congratulations, and that you are now, of course, COVID has, you know, set up a lot of I guess, new avenues for both providers and for patients that you do accept telemed appointments. So those are
I'm completely virtual. Yeah.
Okay.
I went virtual at the beginning of COVID. Like I said, just moved down here the last few months, have not reestablished an office space with the Delta variant and whatever else is going on. We're kind of holding off on looking for office space for right now. So I'm virtual, which, you know, pros and cons. I don't have the opportunity to kind of see the entire person, which I do think is very important for good psychotherapy. But at the same time, it allows me to see a lot of people who couldn't get to me, not in the area. And it has the added benefit, I think, especially for trauma survivors who feel very unsafe, you know, leaving their homes or getting on the road, to be able to still have therapy in the safety of their home, their apartment, their own space, and still be able to do that. So, you know, I see a lot of benefit to it as well.
Okay. So, well, that's good to know, because those that are listening that are going to look you up on these websites and on Facebook, want to get a hold of you, know that they can have access to you whether they live in beautiful San Diego or not.
Yeah.
Then it does look like there's another that's the same one. So I'm going into your bio and I'm taking a look at what you provided here. So you are the program director of the Center for Positive Sexuality.
Sure. Just a quick plug. Center for Positive Sexuality is an amazing organization in Los Angeles. I was invited onto their board a couple of years ago after the director and her partner saw me speak at a conference, actually about a lot of what we talked about tonight. They are dedicated towards positive expressions of sexuality in all different forms. We have a conference coming up in February, so I just want to plug that. And so if people go to positivesexuality.org, they will find the center and find all kinds of good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So, we're down to the last minute of the show, so I just wish to thank you on behalf of NASCA. And the host team, we just really, you know, wish to thank you for coming on this evening. I wanted to thank Kim Lakin from Colorado and John Anderson from Louisiana and Bill Murray, our CEO, for having me host.
Thank you. And you, Penelope.
Our panelist, Peter, yes, oh, of course. And our special guest, Andrew Perry.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, SAAwareness.com. He's the contributor of the book, Me Too, Counselors and Psychotherapists Speak About Sexual Violence and Abuse. And you can also find him on Facebook. So as I always sign off on the shows, all of our responsibility to keep our children safe. There are enough adult eyes in this world to protect every single child. If you see something, it's your responsibility to please say something. So thank you all. Thank you, Andrew Perry, and good night.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was